Hey folks, Jared here with a special treat for you today. I have my old boss, my old CO, the old man. Relax, it's a term of endearment. Doyle Hodge is on the program. Doyle previously served as commanding officer of USS Ross, where I was one of his department heads. We decided to get back together to talk about the new Tom Hanks film Greyhound from a captain's perspective. I will warn you, the episode does contain spoilers, so if you haven't seen the movie yet, maybe watch it before you listen to this. I also have two instances of some extremely mild profanity. Bear with me, I was excited. Finally, my audio quality here wasn't great, so sorry about that. The good news is that Doyle is clear as a bell, and he makes all the good points anyway, so it's a wash. With that, I'll turn it over to Kimber's men.
You're listening to Sea Control, hosted by the Center for International Maritime Security.
Aloha, shipmates, and welcome back aboard Sea Control. We are back in the Navy in pop culture realm today, and we're going to be discussing the new Tom Hanks movie, Greyhound, with the editor of the Texas National Security Review and sometime host of the Horns of the Dilemma podcast, Doyle Hodges. Doyle, thank you for coming on. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Jared.
So, Doyle, can you introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us about your background? I think they'll understand very quickly while you're on this pod with me.
Sure. So I'm Doyle Hodges. As you mentioned, my job is I'm the editor of the Texas National Security Review, which I would commend to your listeners who aren't familiar with it. It's a joint project of the University of Texas and War on the Rocks. It's an academic journal that's interdisciplinary in its approach to national security affairs and seeks to provide rigorous scholarship in a way that is accessible and free from jargon. But before doing that, I spent 21 years as a surface warfare officer. Served aboard frigates, destroyers, cruisers, and commanded a salvage ship as well as a destroyer. Probably the hardest part of commanding the destroyer was the quality of the department heads who worked for me. I had an operations officer by the name of Samuelson, who was just a constant challenge. So to be clear, that is where Jared and I first met, was when he came and worked for me as ops officer when I was in command of Ross. And he was actually an excellent ops officer and really distinguished himself in that tour. After I retired from the Navy, I pursued a PhD at what is now the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs and focused on civil-military relations and national security issues, but certainly still have Navy and especially Surface Navy kind of front and center in my perspective and interests.
Yeah, you're absolutely right in your first assessment of me. Absolute pain in the ass in my part. Thank you for coming on today. I will tell you, I did reach out to Tom Hanks' representation, and he turned us down. So I don't know if that's on you or me. Sorry you couldn't be on the pod today. But to summarize, we are a pair of surface warfare officers with some anti-submarine warfare experience between us and command experience. I'm here. I'm wearing my metaphorical SWO jacket. I don't have the actual one yet, though I do. I have placed it on order. So,
given that it is the hottest day of the year thus far in D.C. today, and that the SWO jacket is, let's just say I'm not among the things I miss about the Navy. The opportunity to wear the SWO jacket does not rank highly among them.
You're missing out. I remain a vocal supporter of the SWO jacket. Anything that we can do and we can steal from the aviation community and upset them, I'm a proponent of. But to get back to Greyhound, it's based on a novel by C.S. Forrester. Doyle, I know you've read the book. I didn't read it until after I had command. When did you read it, and then what is your opinion of the book?
So I think I was about 14 the first time I read The Good Shepherd, and I picked it up, as I recall, at a used bookstore, mostly because I was a huge fan of the Hornblower series and saw another book by Forrester, and I didn't know what I was getting into when I read it. If you haven't read the book, I would commend it to you. It is very cinematic in how it is written. I think The Good Shepherd, along with The Ship, are both books by Forrester that just sort of open in the middle of the action and keep going, much like the movie does. One of the things I really enjoy, you know, the sort of the two great classic maritime literature series are the Hornblower books and then the Patrick O'Brien novels, Jack Aubrey and Stephen Maturin. They're very different, but each have great qualities in their own ways. And what's interesting is that although I think of the O'Brien novels as being more literary and having more character development, one of the things I really appreciate about Forrester is the sort of meditation on character and command that he offers in all of his books. But it's really, really obvious in The Good Shepherd, because here you have an officer, and it doesn't really come out as clearly as it might in the movie, but an officer who is in his first command, is relatively senior, and is put into a position not only of commanding the ship, but being the escort commander for the convoy. It's his first test with people working for him who have been war tested for a couple of years. And it is a task that is impossible to do without taking losses. And so this sort of incredible stress and pressure that's placed on him as he is put into this position, knowing that he's going to take losses, trying to mitigate them, trying to coordinate the efforts not only of his own ship, but also of all of the escorts and coordinate with the convoy. It really is just a terrific read. I highly recommend it.
I was going to ask, you've sort of given a description of what the book is about. Would your description change based on if you were describing the book to a civilian versus describing it to a naval officer?
I think it would. I think it really depends on what you want from the book. I think what I got from it when I was 14 is very different than what I got from it when I read it again before I went back to command. Because I think as a naval officer, I would tell them that it's a book about command. It is a book about dealing with the stresses, the challenges, not having the resources you need, having missions that must be accomplished, and how you balance those things, the toll that it takes on you and what you do. On the other hand, you can also read it as a good adventure story of just what you see in the movie, something that opens in the middle, it has relatively rapid action and keeps going. So I think you can describe it in a couple of different ways and not be inaccurate, depending on how you do it.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you. As I was, you know, talking with my wife about it before we watched it, I kind of describe it as a point of view take on the Battle of the North Atlantic. And then when I talk with, it's really about the burden of command, and it's not the big decisions to me. For me, it was all the banalities that make the captain's life so demanding just by the quantity. And there were two scenes that really jumped out at me. And the ones everybody gravitates to are, hey, do you go to the back of the convoy or rescue the guy in the water? That's not what I was talking about. The burden of command scene to me is that scene immediately after the first battle when Tom Hanks grabs the 1MC. He makes an announcement. Everybody cheers. And then there are six different questions that come at him from different characters, one right after the other. It's, oh, the boilers. Can we bring up depth charges? Do we secure from general quarters? Hot chow. Boom, boom. Just one right after the other. And that, to me, was the captain's life. It's just a never-ending string of these decisions about every possible detail, the captain having to reach him in seconds, and each of them is consequential.
Yeah, and being ripped from his sleeve and being up on the bridge, and then that sort of hesitation to have someone bring him the things that he needs, his gloves, his boots, etc., but at the same time not being able to leave himself to go get it. You know, I think one of the things that resonated with me that I think would resonate with anyone who's had command of a surface warship is just the sort of balance between exhaustion and making good decisions and trying to figure out, you know, how you manage to not allow yourself to get so run down that you can't do what you need to do, but you're still there when you need or you're needed to be there.
Yeah. The other scene for me was the slippers at the end, which I think it's a bigger deal in the book than it was made out to be in the movie. And the way it comes across in the movie, the way it's sold a little bit is, this is this reminder of home. And in the book, the way that I read the book was like, no, he has finally been broken by the number of decisions that he's had to make. And he's now going to relax his sense of discipline in front of his crew members and put these slippers on. I would say, how many nights did you actually sleep in your chair up on the bridge?
You know, it's interesting. My first command tour on Safeguard, I did it more often. And my second command tour on Ross, one of the lessons I learned from command of Safeguard was that I wasn't any better or quicker in making decisions if you woke me up in this disorienting place. I actually did better if I got the phone call and had a process of getting to the bridge. It gave me a little bit of time to get my wits about me and figure out what was going on. I was more likely to make bad decisions if I was so convinced that I was critical that I was sleeping in my chair.
Yeah, that's understandable. So then let's just start with your first impression of the movie. How did you feel about it after you'd watched it?
I loved it. I really, you know, obviously there's things, and a friend of mine who's a naval historian who I quite respect took all sorts of issue with minor issues of historical accuracy and all kinds of things. And there are elements that are different from the book. But it's not about whether this is a guide to how you can historically recreate the Battle of the Atlantic. It's about whether it communicates the sense of being at sea and communicates the stress and the challenges and everything that was there. And all those same things that you and I just discussed from the book came across to me from the movie. It was just, it was right there. It begins, you know, with immediate action, and it never really lets up at all. It just keeps going, going, going. And the pace, the stress, the uncertainty, all of that, I thought they captured so well and just did a terrific job of communicating that. And one of the things that's interesting is, you know, the book develops Krause's character, the captain's character, quite a bit. He is rather introspective. He thinks on things that have happened in his life. The movie, so far as I can recall, I don't think anyone ever calls him by his last name. The only way you know his name is if you watch the credits. And so it doesn't spend a ton of time with character development in the way that the book does, but at the same time, it communicates that sense of it just really well, I thought.
Yeah, I could not believe how quickly it was over. When you say relentless, that is exactly how I felt, and I thought it was true to the book's spirit, while at the same time being a not great representation of what anti-submarine warfare is actually like, which ASW is commonly referred to as awfully slow warfare. This is just a laborious process.
It is, although, you know, I think there's a couple of things. One is that you and I grew up with ASW largely being about passive ASW against long-range targets using systems that analyze very faint sound signals at great distances. That wasn't ASW in the Atlantic. Remember that a submarine in World War II, especially 1942, wasn't a submarine the way we think of it today. It was a surface ship that could hide underwater for short periods. And so the type of ASW they were doing, where detection ranges would be maybe 1,000, maybe 2,000 yards, where the submarine posed a surface gunnery threat in addition to a torpedo threat, where the convoys are steaming at night with no lights, with zigzag patterns, with absolutely rudimentary radio, all these sorts of things. I'm going to, you know, obviously I've not experienced that personally, but I can certainly see where that would be a much different experience of ASW, and awfully slow warfare wouldn't be the way you thought about it under those circumstances.
No, you're absolutely correct. And I probably should have looked at it through a slightly different lens. Just to come back to your point on sort of the, I guess we'll call them historical shortcomings too. About 10 minutes in, Tom Hanks gives some conning command. Well, that's not how you, right about this moment, I think my daughter woke up in the other room. I had a little pause where I went and took care of her and then came back. When I sat back down, I was like, all right, stop worrying about the historical accuracy of some of this and just enjoy the story a little bit more. And then things became much better. But yeah.
Well, a friend of mine who's a retired SWO commented that she had never used the command meet her in the course of her career. And you know, if you watch the movie, you would think that was the most common conning command. And you know, yeah, I think, you know, we all have this tendency to want to be nitpicky about it. But again, when I think about it, one of the reasons that we so rarely used it is that very rarely would you be driving by eye. You would be coming to a course, you'd be steadying, you'd be doing these things. Now put yourself in a situation where you have no or rudimentary radar. You're steaming inside 500 yards of 90 merchant ships. You're doing it at 36 knots. You're trying to figure out where an enemy submarine is. I can see where you might actually be using the command meet her, because all you're really trying to do is to stop the swing of the bow and keep yourself going the direction you're trying to go. So I can't tell you that yes, they did, no, they didn't, but it's plausible. And I wasn't going to let that get in the way.
Yeah, meet her was actually one of my favorite moments of the film, because it's my favorite command to use. I probably got to use it 2, maybe 3 times in my entire career just doing ship handling exercises. So I was like on the point of standing up and cheering when he used it, and then he came right back with it multiple times. Too much jargon, not enough jargon, or just right for you?
So, you know, I think you and I are probably the wrong people to be able to answer or evaluate that question, because, you know, to someone who didn't grow up steeped in this, the command meet her might seem like jargon. You know, to us, it's like we can, you know, have a 10-minute conversation about how much we enjoy using this. from my perspective, I thought they did a decent job of translating the experience in a way where the lack of terminology at times wasn't overly distracting, but it was still accessible. And, you know, my yardstick for that is also my wife, who watched the movie with me and didn't come away saying, boy, I couldn't understand this or that. Now, granted, again, she's been married to me long enough. She's probably more expert on naval jargon than the average person off the street. But I felt like they hit a pretty good balance where, you know, they didn't do everything with precise naval phraseology, but at the same time, it wasn't so terrible that it could be distracting. Although, yeah, it's funny because there are things that we just don't think about in terms of what constitutes jargon. And I remember I was able to get my brother underway for about a half a day with me when I commanded a safeguard. We had gone out to go do an ammo offload. We were coming back in and I was giving line handling commands. And we were heaving around on line one, and I said, "Avast heaving line one." And he just thought that was the funniest thing in the world. He's like, no one uses the word avast. That's the word. That's what you would use. And so, yeah, the ability to recognize jargon may not be a strong point for you and I.
Yeah, to me, I came down in the just right. And again, I'm kind of playing off watching my spouse absorb this. She has not really been exposed to me doing surface warfare officer things. She's been exposed to me doing administrative staff officer things. So, you know, she has not been underway with me or any of that. But, you know, I think it may have been too much for some folks, because as he's getting a contacts report to him, I found myself like starting to plot them out in my head and getting confused. I was like, oh, okay. This may be the point where it's just a little too much for some of you.
Yes.
I will say, in my opinion, this is the best recent Navy movie, and it's been a while since we've had a good one. Do you want to recap some of what we suffered through? I know you said you haven't seen some of these.
Yeah, you know, you gave me a list of Midway, Hunter-Killer, Battleship, and Annapolis, and the only one of that list I've seen is Midway. And I will confess that this was actually one of my concerns before watching Greyhound, was because the CGI in Midway was so terrible, and because some of the trailers for Greyhound made the CGI relatively prominent, I was really worried that I was going to be watching the equivalent of a video game graphic. And again, I think one of the things they did really well is that I didn't find it that way. I didn't find it distracting. Midway, it was a welcome distraction from the acting. You know, in the case of Greyhound, I didn't find that distracting. Hunter Killer, I've not seen. Liam Neeson apparently does have some particular skills, and I guess submarining is among them. Battleship, I will say that I only know people who come into like two categories on Battleship. They either love it as an escapist Navy fantasy, or they just can't get over it and they're like, okay, forget it. And Annapolis, I barely even recall that movie was out. But the bottom line is, you know, I guess the new Top Gun would fall into a relatively recent Navy movie. Certainly Top Gun, the original. But when you and I were discussing other ones, what do we have? We have Crimson Tide. We have Hunt for Red October. But if you want a surface warfare movie, boy, you got to go back a long way to get to that. As I mentioned to you, you had No Way Out, where Kevin Costner was a surface warfare officer. You have a brief 10-minute opening scene where he implausibly runs out and saves a guy who didn't get the word about the weather decks being secured during high winds and heavy seas. And that's about all you got, you know. So it hit me in my happy place. I was very, very pleased that and not only that it was a good Navy movie and it was a good surface warfare movie, but, you know, this is, as some of my friends have groused, only available on the particular network it's on. And I don't know, am I allowed to say which network that is, or is that like product placement?
I don't know. I mean, like, it's on, look, you can look it up. It's on Apple TV.
So. Sure. So I think it's entirely appropriate that Apple decided that their big move that was going to make people subscribe to Apple TV, or at least take the week of free subscription before they canceled, was a surface warfare movie. Because what would draw people in more than that? I mean, can you imagine? You know, it just...
We've been waiting 60-some years. You just mentioned all those. What was the last surface warfare movie? You're back into black and white.
Yeah, I think you are.
So you're in harm's way, you're Mr. Roberts, you're Kane Mutiny, and I think those are kind of the three that go on the surface warfare wall.
And you know, I mean, you just hit like my major, you know, major Navy movies, especially Kane Mutiny and Mr. Roberts. Kane Mutiny, which actually was in color, but Kane Mutiny, while it does have some naval operations, for the most part, is not a surface warfare movie. And neither is Mr. Roberts. They are movies about people, about stresses of character, about command, all set in the context of a ship. But in terms of a movie where surface warfare operations were front and center, yeah, I can't really think of one at all. Maybe they were expendable, going back to the PT boats.
That I think In Harm's Way definitely fall in there as well.
But see, I actually disagree with that. I think there's, I mean, certainly the opening of In Harm's Way, right? That's great. You got the whole Pearl Harbor attack. You got the destroyer getting underway and leaving the captain behind. And you have the classic line, a gut-busting, mother-loving Navy war. But if you think about it, for the majority of the movie, it's not actually surface warfare operations. He goes ashore at Guadalcanal. He does all these other sorts of things. So again, you're focused not so much on surface warfare operations as telling a broader story of the war in the Pacific. And it's, you know, it's okay as that goes. I would put it in the category of movies that I would certainly watch if they were on and that are a little bit cheesy, but enjoyable. But yeah, this sort of, If there's anybody worse than Forrest Gump for being in the wrong place at the wrong time, it's, you know, John Wayne suddenly, who's present at every major event and, you know, is doing all these sorts of things. Yeah, I would actually say probably Midway or Tora are probably also, they're great for Navy operations movies. But again, both focused appropriately with those battles on aviation.
How do you feel about The Final Countdown?
An absolute classic, underappreciated. Probably should have received an Oscar in its own category. You know, the music alone is terrific. The whole idea of the F-14 going up against the Zero. You can't argue with that sort of thing. That's solid.
I just like it for the first few minutes there where it's showing the 1980s carrier flight deck and just the range of aircraft that were present.
Yes. Instead of everything being a Hornet platform of one flavor or another.
So let me ask you, is this a Navy movie, a surface warfare movie, an anti-submarine warfare movie, or, and this is my personal favorite theory, a movie about phone talkers?
Clearly it's about the phone talkers. So I think it is broadly a Navy movie. Certainly, you know, we as surface warfare officers identify with it, but given that there wasn't a distinction between Navy and surface warfare at the time, it's hard to necessarily call it a SWO movie. It was a Navy movie because that was what the Navy did in World War II was this, you know, there were submarines and aviation, but if you thought Navy, the first thing was thinking of ships. I wouldn't call it an anti-submarine warfare movie. I would say anti-submarine warfare is the device that moves the action along. But really what it is it's, as we were saying, it's a movie about command, about challenges, about stress, about all those decisions, and it's set in this wonderful action and has all this richness of ships and driving seas and all these things going on around it. And, you know, I think all those come together in a way that really make the phone talkers shine. That's what allows them to have the pathos that they do.
Yeah, I would say the phone talkers for me, and it was, you know, it's kind of a joke, but I really liked the use of the phone talkers, their knowing looks, they know when to call up the other officers, like, hey, you need to get up here and free the old man. There aren't a ton of enlisted personnel featured in the story. If the story has a tertiary character, it's George Cleveland, the steward.
Right.
And, but otherwise, it is very narrowly focused on Hanks because, as we discussed earlier, it's really about the burden of command. But that phone talker is a stand-in, I think, for a lot of different enlisted personnel who are really the connective tissue that make all the different parts of the ship work together cohesively under the commanding officer's leadership.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting you mentioned Cleveland as the tertiary character. There are only three characters in the movie whose names you learn. in the course of the movie. And you learn them because they are casualties and are buried at sea, and their names are called as that occurs, which I guess I should have said spoiler alert before I said that, because now it occurs to me, since we know Cleveland's name, I've just told you something. But, you know, I that's actually one of the things that I appreciate about it. You know, I think one of the things that I really value from my time as a surface warfare officer is the way that a ship is simultaneously something that reflects very much the personality of its leadership, but also cannot function without every person working together. And, you know, those two things almost seem contradictory, but they're not. And the way in which there's no individual superstar, the captain is not really a star. The captain's doing what's expected of him. That was his job. It isn't that he suddenly steps up and becomes, you know, the XO in Crimson Tide, who's everywhere fighting every fire, doing everything. No, he's doing the captain's job, and everybody else is doing their job, and they're doing it together. And without that, they simply can't get through this nearly impossible task that they're faced with. So I think it's great.
I will definitely put a spoiler alert warning podcast when I cut the intro for this, and I knew it was going to happen, so it's okay, don't worry about it. What were you most excited to see as you came on screen? Was there anything that caught you off guard? You're like, oh man, that.
Yeah, I was trying to think, and I can't really think of anything that took me by surprise or took me off guard in that regard. You know, I think probably in terms of excitement, not as a development in the movie or something that was showcased, it was just, like I said, that I thought the CGI, which I was really worried was going to be distracting, was really good. And I'd say probably if there's one thing that I was excited to see, it's how well they captured the motion of a ship without doing it to the point where it becomes distracting. You get this clear sense that you're in the Atlantic in heavy seas. You're not going to make a viewer seasick, but at the same time, the sort of constant movement and these sorts of things was there. And I think it actually is really important to building the sort of mood of the movie, because you don't have these sorts of rock steady shots or these sorts of things. They're always in motion. That's probably what I was most excited about. And that seems like an odd thing to be excited about, but I think it sets the context really well, and it helps to make the movie as persuasive and as enjoyable as it is.
For me, 10 minutes in, I started explaining to my wife what a maneuvering board was. It was less than 10 minutes until one made an appearance on screen. She's like, do you do that? It's like, I have done that. And then the other one was the blue cover. I kind of forgotten about the blue cover. I don't know. Were those still around when you came in?
They went away a while before your time. Yeah, I'm older than you, Jared, but I'm not that much older than you. No, I have never seen anyone wearing the blue cover in practice, but you're right, that is, it's a good look. I liked it quite a bit there. You know, another thing that I actually really, just one of those small details, but, and it goes back to the experience of command, is how he was changing clothes. And you brought up the issue of the slippers, but when they suffered casualties, when they had a burial at sea, he changed into blues, from working blues to service dress. And he was then in service dress for some subsequent actions that went on. But that's a really, I like that sort of little touch, because it's very accurate in terms of the experiences that as the captain, it's important that you are appropriately attired for the event and the solemnity of the event and doing those things. And I really liked the idea that they thought of it and they had him be the type of commander who would do that. I thought that was neat.
Did you do any burials at sea while you're in command? I should make clear for our listeners, we're not talking about taking combat casualties, but there is a program through which veterans can be buried at sea from U.S. naval vessels, where you will receive the remains in advance. You hold a ceremony while you're out at sea, and you're doing it on the back of the fantail. The family gets a copy of the chart normally marked where their relative was buried, as well as a note from the commanding officer.
Yeah, we did. And no, it's one of those things that can seem like a little bit of an inconvenience when you're given the tasking, because usually it comes at a time when you are trying to get out and do some unit level training and exercise the ship the way you want to exercise it, rather than performing for a group that's assessing you from off board. But it's actually also kind of cool because it is something that's very meaningful to the families that are involved. And, you know, I think we've all heard the horror stories of not judging the wind correctly or something else. But I don't think you can have command on the East Coast and not have done a pretty good number of them, just because they at one point had a decent backlog that they were trying to work their way through. And I will say, actually, we only ever did cremains. I never did one with a casket, only ever with cremains.
Yeah, I'm not sure I've ever even heard of one being done with a body other than ash.
Yeah.
Was there a best swell moment for you?
Oh, wow. You know, it's, again, I mean, there's so many swell moments. Choosing one is kind of difficult, but I loved the ship driving. I loved the commands that he was giving as he went through that. I loved the coordination with CIC and the XO down there, you know, plotting stuff as they were going. I loved the fact that they, you know, again, it's not a perfect historical recreation, but they didn't present sonar as this powerful seesaw sort of sensor. So you got into inside minimum sonar range and you went from there. Yeah, I'm not answering your question well, because I have a hard time like narrowing down one thing as a SWO moment per se. Yeah, I don't know. How about you?
So one, malfunctioning electronics is
yes,
extremely relatable.
Yes, the windshield wipers. You're absolutely right. That's exactly it. And the, well, I don't know. It could be this or it could be that. And that frustration, you're absolutely right. I had forgotten about that.
Yeah. The windshield wipers on Ross. That was a struggle until he went through a significant yard period. The other one that my wife asked me about. So they're driving through at one point, and Tom Hanks, they're going to cut through the convoy, and he makes a turn and doesn't realize that he's coming up on the merchant, and they pass, and there's like 30 yards clearance
between them. Yeah,
it just reminded me of being up in the Northern Arabian Gulf one time. We're operating in the vicinity of an anchorage. And I just cut the engine off because we're going to do drift ops while we sit up there in this box for the evening. And this moored vessel, it's got its anchored light, or its anchoring lights on here. It's got, everything's all lit up, and it appears to be anchored. It's showing you that it's anchored in AIS. And I'm watching it. That looks like it's moving. It looks like, and then I get BM2 screaming at me, the bosun's mate second class, from up on top of where our lookouts are sitting, screaming at me. It was like, sir, that ship's underway. And my wife triggered me when she says, like, how did they not see that? I mean, it wasn't 30 yards, but it was much closer to a large moving vessel than I wanted to be. I was like, that's what being on a small ship, maneuvering quickly in and amongst a bunch of merchant ships feels like. That is exactly it. And
now, yeah.
Now I'm going to need to step away and go take a shower.
Yeah, and that's, yeah, that's one of the other things that just strikes me is, you know, again, our experience of destroyers is something that's close to 10,000 tons, if not greater, right? They, in the movie, they asserted that the destroyer was a Fletcher class, which in the book, I believe it's a Wilkes class, if I recall correctly, but, or a Mahan class, actually, I'm sorry. But, you know, Mahan class was 1,500 tons. A Fletcher class was 2,000 tons. So tiny, absolutely tiny, and packed with people, as many people as you had on a DDG 51, right? You got 350 people on there. So more than a DDG 51 these days, you know, and five-inch guns and boilers and all this stuff. And yeah, it's like just incredible. The ship handling, so different because the difference in sizes and displacements and speeds. I mean, these things were going 38, 40 knots because that's what you needed to do to be able to sprint around the convoy. You know, I think I grew up with gas turbine ships and, you know, you hear the phrase 31 knot Burke and you think, well, yeah, he was fast. No, 31 knot Burke meant he was going slower because one of his vessels was damaged and could only make 31 knots, you know? So, which, you know, that's also the, it's amazing how much quicker stuff happens at that speed. One of those things, when I had the salvage ship, our top end was 12 knots with a following current and very cool water for good heat exchange with the diesels. And I when I got underway for the first time in command of Ross, we're heading down Thimble Shoals Channel at 15 knots. And I think it's been 5 years since I went this fast in a warship. stuff. I mean, it develops differently. So the ship driving is great about that, and I really appreciated that part of the movie.
Were you surprised at how muted the violence was?
Not really. You know, I think this is something that you certainly get from the book, and if you've read much about the Battle of the Atlantic, you know, the sort of horrifying thing is the violence is muted when it's not on your ship, right? Because a merchant ship's there and then it's gone. And maybe you've got, you know, there's one instance, since we're putting spoiler alerts out there, one instance where they recover four survivors from a merchant ship that sunk by one of the U-boats. And, you know, that wasn't an era of merchant ships with crews of 25. That was an era where a merchant ship had 200, 250 maybe, because it had, you know, a large steam-powered engine and all these things to maintain. Yeah, cargo movement wasn't happening with, you know, highly automated systems. So the violence from the outside looks muted. And then if you're happen to be on the ship that's hit, it's sudden and final. And I mean, that was the nature of the Battle of the Atlantic. I mean, you know, 3,500 merchant ships. It's astounding. You know, there aren't 3,500 merchant ships, probably, certainly not under U.S. registry, but I don't think any country has 3,500 ships under their own registry anymore. Maybe, you know, Liberia or Panama flags the convenience, but it didn't surprise me. I mean, I appreciated that they didn't try to dramatize it and make it into something that, you know, like I said, I think I alluded earlier to Crimson Tide and this whole sort of like the hero of shipboard firefighting, here comes the XO. Although that reminds me of a wonderful broadside cartoon with like three people sitting around a table going, I didn't care for the movie. I didn't care for the movie. I really liked it. And the captions, find the XO in this picture. I thought it was a good representation of it. And, you know, I mean, they lose a number of merchant ships in the course of that convoy, as they did in the book, as they did in real life. And it's muted because you weren't on board those merchant ships. So,
I like that it happened for the most part off screen, even when they're taking hits. You're not really, you kind of see it from the character's point of view as it's something that happened back aft.
Right.
Of course, he has to deal with the aftermath of that, but you're not just confronted. It's not like the first 17 minutes of Saving Private Ryan. It's left a little bit to the imagination.
Yeah.
Did you have any other thoughts? Otherwise, I'll wrap it up here.
No, I just, like I said, I really, really enjoyed the movie. I thought that it did justice to the book without attempting to be a perfect recreation of it. And similarly, I think it did justice to the experience of the Battle of the Atlantic without, you know, attempting to be a map to historically recreate it yourself. I would really encourage your listeners to pick up a copy of the book, because I think you can still get an awful lot from the book having seen the movie. The movie of necessity kind of focuses on the things that occur externally, whereas so much of the book is internal action in the captain's head as he thinks about, tries to deal with these things. And I think that's a richness that only comes from the experience of reading it. So I would encourage your listeners to read it. And it's one of those where I wouldn't say, oh, the book is better than the movie or the book is worse than the movie. The book is different than the movie. I really enjoyed the movie, but I would say it's still well worth the experience of reading the book as well.
Well, that's all the time that we have for today. I'd like to thank my guest, Doyle Hodges. Doyle, where can we find you online and what are you working on next?
Sure. So I would encourage your listeners to go check out the journal's website, tnsr.org. All of our articles are available for free. We are an open access journal, so there's no membership there. And working on an upcoming special issue of the journal, which should be interesting to readers, as well as working on content for the Horns of Dilemma podcast and occasionally things at War on the Rocks. So.
Thank you again for coming on. For our listeners, we'll have links to the journal that Doyle's referencing there available in the show notes. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, Jared. I want to fill the barrel counter. Way high, boy, in the alley.
where I met with Greasy Annie. Bloody Annie's in